Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. And our artists this week, we're going to go off the reservation just a little bit because the art is so darn cool that we have to talk about it. But it's primarily needlework, crochet and knitting, a lot of knitting, some embroidery. They threw in a little embroidery in their display. But there on the left is Emily Dundee O'Deal. Hi, Emily.
Hi there.
Good to have you with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, and then Ken Lee Chapin. And hi, Ken.
Hey, hello, everybody.
Just so it male and female, so the listening audience should be able to determine that, I would hope.
Right.
So Ken wrote to me, I don't know, 3-4 weeks ago, and offered to do a show, and because it was knitting, like I said, we're off the reservation a little bit, knitting and crochet, my initial reaction was, that's not going to be a fit till I looked at the art. And then it was, I'm all in. We got to talk about this. So what you guys do, and there's got to be a term, so help me with a term. What you do is these massive displays in, say, a lobby or an exhibition space. Is there a term for this?
Fiber art, fiber installation art is okay. Often what we'll use.
Okay.
Installations.
Something like that. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, these things are so cool. Well, people will see in the photos and in the video, see these things. But both of you come together to form this business really from two different paths. And Emily, you're the one who started the knitting problem.
Yes, I did. Yeah. That is my fault entirely.
So first started out, you just taught yourself to knit, just something to do with your hands and pastime, or how did that get started?
Yeah, you know, I was working in Hollywood out in California and working on a lot of movies and television shows, and there's just a ton of sit around and wait time. Yeah. On set. And so I taught myself to knit mainly, like you said, as a way to keep my hands busy, to keep my brain occupied while I was on set for these really long 15, 16 hour days. And it just so happened that I got completely obsessed with it right away, which I think happens a lot with crafters. You know, you find your thing and you just go all in. So right. I used to knit into the wee hours of the night. I knitted all day on set. And slowly people started to ask me to make things for them. And I did not know how to make anything since I was self-taught, didn't know how to read a pattern. But I also had this background as an actor. And actors are taught to say yes to pretty much any question they are asked. Do you know how to do a triple pirouette? Yes. Do you know how to ride a horse? Yes. So when people asked me, would you please make me this shawl, this cardigan, this bikini, I was just in the habit of saying yes and figuring it out. And it served me really, really well because slowly I started to design. Well, I guess I designed all of my own pieces from the beginning because I didn't read patterns. But it gave me a certain level of confidence in my ability to design and just figure out how to do things.
Let me interrupt you. So as you're learning this and people are asking you, you're not going and finding patterns. You're just figuring out how to.
Oh, yeah. I still to this day haven't read a pattern.
Okay. All right. Bravo to you.
That's not entirely true. I've read a couple of patterns over the years. I don't know that I've ever completed one because I get annoyed and I want to change something. So it's usually best for me not to try to follow a pattern at all.
I'm always so jealous of those kinds of minds that just work it out. That's just,
well, you know that though, it goes in the reverse too, because I'm jealous of the minds who can pick up anybody's pattern and read it and understand what they're saying. And I write my own patterns for my own reference, but I guarantee you wouldn't be able to follow it. I don't have that skill.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that was kind of what it was. I was working with, some designers in fashion. They happened to be friends of mine. It wasn't really a goal of mine, but I was doing a lot of knitting. They had a store. They started throwing my pieces into their store. I started spending a lot of time working on their projects and sort of in the background working on my projects in the back of the studio. And after a couple of years of doing that is when I decided to open my own shop, which was about a block away from where I was working with my friends, which seemed very, yeah. very far away at the time. And it was kind of the same thing. I didn't know how I was going to make any of that work. I had just picked up the knitting machine. I had been knitting, hand knitting for about 10 years at that point, but I had just picked up a knitting machine maybe a month earlier. Mm-hmm. And that's when, through a series of events, it just sort of unfolded that I opened up this shop that I had absolutely no business opening. I had no money. I had no clients. I had no plan. But things fell into place and it felt like the right time to do it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I have just enough money in my bank account to get me through 3 months of what is likely to be a completely humiliating event for me. And I was terrified of looking stupid and mm-hmm. opening up a business that I shouldn't have opened and not knowing how to run it, not really knowing how to make clothes. And I decided that would be really good for me to just try it anyway and to be willing to fail and to be willing to fail publicly. Yeah. And I just decided like that would be probably good for me and the strength of who I am as a person.
Yeah.
And I got really incredibly lucky. Just like when I was on set, just people would randomly walk into my store and ask me to make things for them. I ended up working in the entertainment industry quite a lot, doing a lot of movies and television and commercials and music videos. And it really kept me afloat such that while it wasn't always easy peasy and there were challenges, it was about 6 months after I opened the shop that it dawned on me that I had made it past my 3 month failure mark. Everything was icing after that. You know, I had kind of done this thing that felt terrifying. It felt not very wise. And somehow it ended up kind of working. And I ended up getting to learn how to do so many different things, whether it was hand knitting, machine knitting, crocheting, embroidery, building sets, coming up with costumes and set pieces and props and all manner of things. So anyhow, I did that for about 5.5 years.
Let me back you up. So in many ways, this is your classic Hollywood actor story, waiting tables, get discovered, and it takes off from there in its own way.
Exactly. But if only the Hollywood dream were to become a knitter, then I have truly lived the Hollywood dream.
If that were the case. But to start, I mean, you know, what is it? Small businesses, they suggest you're capitalized for 2 years. And you, you got 3 months and you went for it. That is gutsy. That is really gutsy. But yeah.
Or devastatingly stupid. But well, lucky.
I'm going gutsy. I'm going to give you credit for gutsy. All right. Now, so this shop is not your classic knitting shop with balls of yarn everywhere and patterns and come in and make a scarf or something. This is all basically clothing and fashion oriented shop.
Correct. So the way that it was set up is that,
And we're gonna get to you in a minute, Ken. Don't worry.
We sure
about
are.
It.
I'm gonna blow through all of this, my love.
I love this story.
The way that the shop was set up is that I made everything on site. So I had all of my tools. I had a variety of knitting machines that I did not yet know how to use, that I had found on random places like eBay for cheap. And and so I spent the first several weeks there just knitting and knitting and knitting into the wee hours of the night, trying to figure out what this shop was going to be. And every time I completed a piece, I put it up into the front of the boutique. And slowly that's sort of how it morphed into being. The front third was a public boutique where people could come in and shop. For the most part, it was all one of a kind. I made a handful of duplicates, but I got bored really quickly doing that. So I had a tendency just to make all one of a kind pieces. So customers were able to come in and shop in the front and watch me work in the back. And And, you know, there were some traditional elements to the shop in that once a month I held what I called knit night and invited all of my hookers that I called them. and we enjoyed wine and cheese and sweets and all sat around knitting. And over the years, it became kind of this awesome party of a really wide variety of people from all walks of life, some of whom were knitters, some of whom were crocheters, some of whom had never picked anything up and were just fascinated by it. And it became a really wonderful community event that happened once a month. So that was probably the most traditional element of the shop.
Okay. Yeah.
But other than that, it was pretty much just a knit design house where there were one-of-a-kind pieces, and more often than not, where my bread and butter was on custom clothing.
Yeah. Now, there was a story. I tell the story of the knitting machine, the first knitting machine. I saw it was either in a video or I read it in my research, but somebody gave you a knitting machine and you
and I resented it. Yeah, you know, I had been hand knitting for many years. A friend of mine tried to give me a knitting machine, and somehow he ended up backing over it with his car.
Oh, jeez.
And I somehow felt like saved by the bell, like I wasn't going to have to now start cheating by using a knitting machine, because that's really what I thought it was. I didn't understand what a knitting machine was, and so I thought it was cheating. And several years later, another woman who I knew who was a machine knitter, she wanted to take yoga lessons from me at the time. And I was teaching and I didn't know how to say no. And so when she offered to pay me with a knitting machine instead of money, I said yes. And I really wanted to say no because I just didn't think that I would ever find myself sitting at a knitting machine.
Right,
I thought it would
end
up in the back of the closet and that I would be giving her yoga lessons for free, which would have been pretty typical of me at the time. And but I said yes. She came over for her first lesson, and after her lesson we sat down at the knitting machine for about a half an hour and she showed me the basics of it. And it's a very, very basic machine. You know, it's a chunky manual knitting machine with no bells and whistles, no motor, no computer, no color changer, no punch card, nothing. Very, very basic. And I watched what she was doing and I started to become fascinated. And after about a half an hour, she left and I sat back down at the knitting machine to see if I could recreate what she had just shown me. And, I mean, other than sleeping, I didn't get up for about 2 weeks. I just lived on that knitting machine. And what was really amazing for me about that process, I mean, it changed my whole life. Uh-huh. That knitting machine changed the trajectory of my life and ultimately, you know, Ken and my world. We didn't know each other at the time, but, it was a monumental shift in my world. What it showed me was that week I started to lay down in bed and see these slideshows of different pieces, sweaters and dresses and all kinds of different things that I had no idea were swimming around in my head.
Mm-hmm.
But there they were showing themselves to me one design after another, like an old school MySpace slideshow kind of style.
Yeah.
And I would have to get up out of bed and go sketch, which is something I had never done. I'm terrible at it, by the way, but I did get up in the middle of the night to sketch these ideas because I thought, I got to document these. Like, there's too many of them flowing through my head to be able to remember in the morning. So what the knitting machine did for me, and I will always be a hand knitter. That's always a part of the project. But what the knitting machine did for me is that it gave me the ability to experiment with an idea that I had in my head that I can now maybe take a few hours to explore and see if it's worth figuring out and worth perfecting. As a hand knitter, it might take me days or weeks to be able to get to the point of knowing whether my idea is going to work or not, because I, you know, I'm not working at this scale. You know, even before going into giant knitting and giant installation art, I was still doing, you know, rather intricate gowns and sweaters, and you know, they're not quick things.
Right.
So having the ability to just experiment with an idea made me realize that it was as though the ideas now had a place to go. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know there was a log jam before, but there clearly had been.
So really, you know, because when you say knitting machine, the first thought is that makes you into a factory. But because now I can crank stuff out. But what it really did was release the artist in you.
It really did. You know, and if you're going to use a knitting machine to crank stuff out, you can do that. But you have to decide what it is that you want to crank out and crank that out over and over again.
Yeah.
If you want to crank out an original piece every time you sit down at the knitting machine, which I do, it is not production style, you know? And like I said, it's manual. So every single stitch that needs to be manipulated needs to be manipulated by my hand with a tool.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm sitting there constantly moving the needles around and moving the yarn and increasing and decreasing and cabling and all manner of different things. So what it really does is once I've set everything up for my row, I can do the entire row in one fell swoop rather than doing it stitch by stitch.
Right.
But by the time I get to the next row, chances are I'm going to have to make some adjustments again.
Start over, yeah. Because I watched one video and it looked like watching you set that up, what little there was there, reminded me of a weaver setting up a loom.
That absolutely.
So involved. And I guess it essentially is the same tool, just a different medium in terms of.
Yeah, it's a really similar process. Obviously, the way that the, warp and weft and all of that works with weaving is different. But the idea of being really attentive to your machine, you need to be paying attention to what you're doing.
Right. So then, to help me understand. So then, all right, I'm going to do a row, a knitted row. So you can set that up. And it looked like you just slid something across, and then that knits that row.
Correct.
And then now you're ready for the next row, as opposed to sitting there with needles and knit and purl all the way across till you get to the end, and then you can come back on another one. So, exactly. So I can see
in
how
essence,
the,
I can knit row by row rather than stitch by stitch.
Yeah. But I can see how that frees up your mind now, because now you can start to, these ideas can start to come to fruition without time consumption of the needles. Yeah.
Exactly. Because so much of that time is spent, in essence, knitting and purling something very simple until you get to, you know, a change in the stitch or a change in the shape of the garment. But in between, there's so much knitting and purling that if you can kind of plow through that a little bit quicker with a knitting machine, then that's really useful.
Yeah.
That said, the knitting machine is not the appropriate tool for a lot of things.
Yeah.
There are certain things that are much easier on needles than they are on a bed of what are in essence latch hooks, and vice versa.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to leave you right there in the process. I'm going to go over to Ken, because now, Ken, you come to this. What curator, artist, producer, tell your story, and then so we can bring you together.
Yeah. I would say most of my time historically in the art world has been behind the scenes, herder of cats, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, I started doing some installation artwork, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, frightening number, which I think is probably one of the, in terms of sort of hands-on creativity, is one of the ways that I show up in our partnership. But I do love to produce things. I love being on the phone with people and figuring things out and chasing down venues and sponsors. And I love all that stuff. I guess that's my yarn, is people and community. And I think one of the things that I've enjoyed over the years that Emily and I have been working together is finding ways to obviously place the artwork that we make, but I really like finding out how this might matter to the audience beyond the, oh, I went and saw that and went home.
Mm-hmm.
We really like it when people, like with Moon, like we really like it when people stand in front of our artwork and feel touched and cry.
Mm-hmm.
because that's one of the things that we're angling for is meeting people in at a place that matters to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then seeing what does that look like.
Yeah.
It's great to see people feeling touched by the work that you make.
But the thing that gets your motor running though is finding places to put your art, connecting with the people, getting sponsors, figuring out what can fit in the space, all those things that take away from Emily's art time.
Yeah. That's a great way of putting it. One of the things that I do sort of see it as part of my role to keep, to free Emily up so that she can knit.
Yeah.
Now that's one of the things that really gets my motor running, but before that ever happens, the thing that really gets me going is when we're sitting at home and an idea strikes one of us, and then we are off to the conceptual races.
Okay.
And I would say that in terms of finding joy in the work, that's probably where that whole thing starts is,
yeah.
And then I like to solve the problems. You know, yeah. I'm a problem solver by nature. And, when Emily says, hey, I want to knit a nearly 500 square foot fiber diorama based on the children's story, Good Night Moon, I say, yeah, that sounds great. And then just open myself up to dealing with whatever it is that has to be dealt with.
Yeah. Yeah. That's your art.
Which is fun. Yeah. That and the people side. I mean, right. Emily's good with people too, but. I like it.
Yeah. All right. So how do you come together, Emily? How do you guys come together and say, hey, we got to do this?
Well, we came together online.
Okay. It is 2025. So of course you
it
came
is
together
2025.
Online.
that said, to clarify, we came together on Etsy.
Ooh, okay.
not your traditional.
It's different.
Not the
site.
Traditional.
It's yeah. different.
I actually had been sort of leaning into doing more giant knitting, which wasn't really a thing yet. And giant knitting needles didn't exist on the market yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was rigging things like broomsticks and what have you to do this giant knitting. You know, I would take a number, you know, a chunky yarn, and I would hand knit an I-cord out of it to make myself chunky yarn that didn't yet exist on the market, and then use my broomsticks to make some big chunky whatever. And I was about this close to having knitting needles made for me custom because they just didn't exist. And right before I pulled the trigger, I went back on Etsy, where I had been countless times looking for these things for years, almost a decade. And lo and behold, somebody had opened up a shop about a month earlier. And not only did he have the giant knitting needles that I was looking for, he had beautiful giant knitting needles, like beautiful wooden knitting needles. And not only that, he had them, he was making them circular, which, I just thought that I had found gold. So it was my stepdad who was going to make me those knitting needles.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, never mind. I found somebody. Let's just go with this guy's needles. And so my mother purchased Ken's knitting needles. I believe she might have been his first customer. and when he reached out to her a few weeks later to check and see how she was enjoying her new knitting needles, she said, oh, they're not for me. They're for my daughter. She's got a place in LA. Let me connect the two of you. And she can tell you how she likes the needles. And so there began a very professional, very appropriate relationship between Ken and myself for about a year or year and a half, where we'd hop on the phone together. I'd give him feedback on his needles. He may ask me a question on behalf of one of his clients that he didn't know how to answer, and I'd give him the answer. So we just had a very professional relationship, long distance for a while, until one day we got on the phone and something was different. I don't know why, but something was different. And, you know, within a matter of weeks, both of our lives had been upturned and we were together in Colorado and sort of faced with this idea of combining our businesses. I had just shut down my shop of 5.5 years, and he had his online needle shop. And so we sort of right off the bat combined forces. But it took several years of us running that needle business, and we sold some knitting patterns and some yarn and kind of did that game for a little while. And at some point a few years ago is when it started to transition into to making art together, oftentimes using these needles. But that's how we came together, was I wanted to do some giant knitting. He happened to make the most beautiful knitting needles just in time for me to get them. And that's how it happened.
All through that great dating app, Etsy.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
If only they knew.
If only they knew.
Ken, whatever compelled you to make giant knitting needles? I mean, I mean, anybody who does woodworking, I got to believe that's the last thing that's on their mind. What?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm not a knitter. It just happens that, you know, during that part of my life, I had started an innovation lab. I was really into design as a methodology for leading and developing and engaging teams across sectors. And I had been working with a high school in downtown Cleveland that was a new high school, and they were called the design, I think, design lab early college, but it was a design based high school. And they were wanting to integrate, move beyond a design school in name, but to become one culturally as well, if that makes sense. So for about a year and a half, I worked directly with the students and the faculty and the parents and the community at large to start to integrate different design principles into the culture of this school. And I was in a workshop, you know, with this group of kids, and we were doing a design exercise about, you know, there's a lot of drugs, a lot of crime, a lot of incarceration, a lot of poverty in this community. And these young people were like, well, we want to, I think we were redesigning their life, maybe doing an exercise along those lines. And, you know, they didn't want to work for other people. They wanted financial freedom. And I said, oh, you know, you could start your own business. And it's so much easier than it used to be because you don't need a building.
Right.
You could just start an online business. I was totally talking out of my backside because I had never done that before. I just, you know, I just knew it was true.
Yeah.
And not necessarily that it applied to them, but that it was true.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of a cart before the horse thing, but without any experience running an online business, I said that it was really the ticket out of poverty. And so I had to hurry up and get some experience. So,
oops.
Because as a, yeah, well, it's sort of like Emily in Hollywood, right? Yeah, I can do a pirouette.
Yeah.
And so, you know, long story short, a friend of mine was a knitter. And she had seen these giant knitting needles, and I thought, well, I can make that. I mean, I can make that easily.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, I launched this project basically to cover my butt with these students and go, yeah, see, you can do this. And as it turns out, you know, I wasn't that far off base because, you know, we ended up designing and creating the world's largest collection of giant knitting needles, anywhere from a size 19 to a size 200. And you know, there was no knitting needle size chart for these needles at the time. Now you can see a size 50 and sometimes you'll see a 70 pop up, but there was no standard. So we had to create our own needle size chart. Circular straights. I think our longest is 8 feet long. We've Holy shipped these smokes. Things. Yeah, it's ridiculous. You don't need all these sizes, but as a design guy and somebody running an innovation consultancy, it was about exploring like what are the constraints, what are the limits of this, and yeah. It felt like a new market, you know, because size 50 was the biggest needle you could find, and not many of those, and I don't really even think many people use size 50s. I think it was just this really big needle that languished out on the periphery of knitting that got hot. And so, you know, we started experimenting with circulars and straights and, you know, knitting needles that were straight but not round. So we started making square straights. Then we started making square circulars. I think we made a triangular one. We toyed around with an octagonal one, really just like poking around and exploring the experience that knitters have, and then equipping them hopefully with beautiful tools. You know, because we really wanted people to be able to create with these things, but we wanted them to stand on their own. You know, and some of our early customers, that was the feedback that we got. These are so beautiful. When I'm not using them, they hang on my wall.
Oh, okay.
These are so beautiful. You know, so they did turn into a piece of artwork in their own right, which was gratifying for me. But yeah, that's how I got into making knitting needles. And I'm so glad that I did, you know, because otherwise it's unlikely that we would be here telling this story, know, if I didn't have to cover my butt and, you know, make a setting knitting needles so that these kids didn't think I was a fraud.
Right, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Open your mouth, go home at night and go, now, what am I going to do?
Yeah. And I got to tell you, that behavior has not changed.
Okay.
We are very much, that was one of the things that I learned about Emily, early on is, you know, we relate to the dynamic of cart and horse a little differently. I don't think that either one of us are really afraid of, you know, making mistakes or messing up. So, you know, and I think Emily, you know, really spoke to this, you know, when you're in an audition and they ask you if you can do something, you say, of course I can. And then you just figure out how, and that's how we work on everything. You know, everything that, you know, whether it was Tom or Frog or Moon or other projects that we're working on, everything that we do is a prototype in some way for the next thing that we're working on. And we don't always know where this technique that Emily has never done before is going to show up someday, but they always do. And there are tons of problems. I mean, you can imagine, you know, it's one thing, you know, if you're working from a pattern and somebody makes, you know, a typo or you drop a stitch and you have to figure that kind of stuff out. Well, it is guaranteed that we're always going to be figuring things out for the first time, because first time stuff shows up every time we work on something, whether it's material, technique, how do we hang it? Where do we put it? How do two people transport a 500 square foot fiber art installation?
Right.
Right. Because it is just the two of us. So everything that we do is designed so that it only takes the two of us to execute on the project.
Okay.
Which right. adds a level of complexity that, you know, if we were like Chihuly and had a, you know, a whole yeah. stable of artists working for us, you know, the videos of us trying to move Frog around are
laughable. Wouldn't be so funny.
Wouldn't be so funny.
Yeah. I would like yeah. to know how Chihuly gets his pieces all around the world without breaking all of them. I'd like to know yeah. that.
Crates.
No kidding. Okay, so out of all this then comes the company Dundee and Lee, using your middle names, Dundee and Lee, to give a company name. So, Emily, what is the first installation? And how does this – so you have all these visions of now we can do these displays. You know, I've connected with a guy who makes the needles that allow me to knit the big thick yarns, and some of those are ridiculous. I mean, it's like you're knitting ropes with logs. It's something else yeah. to see. Yeah. So how do we get started now? What's the first display?
Well, it kind of is in reverse order, strangely.
Of course, because it's you guys. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So several years ago, if there are details that Ken wants to fill in here, that's great. But generally, the idea is that we found ourselves with an opportunity in front of us, where Ken was going to be able to do, and he really should be the one to say what his work is and all of this, but he was going to be able to do an element of work inside of the community that was really exciting, that also required an element of art. And so that was a really wonderful way for the two of us to come together. And when Ken asked me what I would do, I found myself, it felt like it came out of nowhere. It didn't actually come out of nowhere, but I found myself blurting out the words, I would knit Goodnight Moon. And it sounded like such a ludicrous idea. But the reason that was in my head is that years earlier when I was working on all of these commercials and stuff, I just had this idea of making a fully immersive environment all out of yarn. I thought it would be the coolest thing. I didn't think I'd ever get a chance to do it, but mm-hmm. it was floating in the back of my head as a, wouldn't that be neat to do someday? And I ended up getting this job for Old Navy, where while it wasn't 100% yarn, it was a very, very yarn and knitting heavy commercial. You know, tables and chairs and coffee makers and Christmas trees and fireplaces and all manner of things, all knitted. And it felt like this kind of amazing opportunity that landed in my lap. Like, look at this. I'm going to get to make this amazingly fully immersive knitted environment. Right. But of course, every bit of yarn they brought me was like creamsicle, orange and white and acrylic and awful. And so it was an incredibly fun job to do, really, really satisfying, but it left me wanting a little bit. Mm-hmm. It left me wanting to do a version of this immersive environment that maybe could be more beautiful, that maybe could be more meaningful, and that I would have a little more control over mm-hmm. because I was just sort of a hired hand for Old Navy doing precisely what it is that they were asking right. me to sure. do. So I did have this fantasy of maybe coming up with a completely ethereal world out of nowhere. But that day when Ken asked me what I wanted to do, out shot out of my mouth, I would knit Goodnight Moon. And so that's what it was.
Yeah.
It's what it decided to be.
Now, for those who don't know, and I was one when I first started researching you guys, Goodnight Moon is this really quite simple children's book that
– yes.
Had its own story, but eventually caught on in the world of children's book reading and moms and dads and little kids and those kinds of things. And I had that. So that was my tangent as I'm researching was what is this Goodnight Moon? And so I had to go learn all about that too. Why Goodnight Moon? Is it something from your childhood?
For sure. I mean, it was definitely one of those books that that stayed with me in my childhood that I found myself reading. I think I shared this with Ken the other day that I found myself reading long after it was age appropriate So I was reading chapter books, but as a fun, you know, just comforting sort of a read, I would break out Goodnight Moon every so often. It just felt like a really special book. And it, you know, one of the things that we've discovered through this project is that it was apparently a really special book for a whole lot of people. We actually delayed our project by a year because Goodnight Moon was turning 75. And so what that meant is that it was entering the public domain. And what that meant is that we were free and clear to make any kind of artwork based on Goodnight Moon that we wanted. Okay. We didn't need any permission or copyright issues. And about, maybe 3 weeks before we opened, we got a call from somebody who was participating in one of our tangent projects that Ken thought up, which is called One Story, Many Voices, where people across the world recorded themselves in 40 plus different languages reading the story Goodnight Moon. So one of the ladies who was participating in that gave us a call and said, hey, just want to make sure that you're allowed to do all of this. You know, I want to participate, but I don't want to do it if this is a copyright infringement.
Right, right.
I said, oh, no worries. We're at 75th anniversary, going to the public domain, free and clear, no problem.
And she said, been tracking this for a year.
Oh, we've been tracking it. Every single blog, every article, you know, where we see that it's going into the public domain. How exciting. So she says, you know, you might want to check your sources again, because I don't think it's going into the public domain. I thought that she's got to be wrong. That's ridiculous. We went back, and every single blog and article that we had read had retracted its information and said, so sorry that we told you this was going into the public domain, but as it happens, they've extended their copyright for 20 more years.
Oh, no.
So we panicked. You know, here we are. I mean, we have put many, many, many moons of our lives into this project, and we're weeks away from opening, and all of a sudden, like, we might have done this wrong. you know, we might not actually have the permission to do this because life is just bizarre. The way that it worked out is that we realized a few weeks before opening that my mother, who was once upon a time a midwife who did home birth deliveries, just so happened to have delivered the child of Thatcher Hurd, who is the son
of
the illustrator Goodnight Moon, Clement Hurd. And not only did she deliver his child, but her birthing partner keeps meticulous records and still had his home phone number.
Oh, for crying out loud.
Which she gave to us, and he picked up.
Oh.
So we find ourselves on the phone with the son of Goodnight Moon's illustrator, sharing with him all of our worries about the fact that we're now not in the public domain.
Right.
And he says, I don't think you have anything to worry about. The project that you're doing, you know, shouldn't actually infringe on anything. But since it takes forever to go through the HarperCollins process, would you like the name of my contact at HarperCollins to speed this along? To which we said, yes, thank you very much. And fortunately, within about a day or two, we had the blessing both of Thatcher Hurd and of HarperCollins Publishing.
Holy smokes. Oh, when you when you first found out that that it wasn't going into public domain, I can't believe your heart's sleepless nights, everything.
Oh. No, we got very, very lucky. And we've continued to have a lot of wonderful fortune and great support across the board, including from HarperCollins Publishing. Yeah. They've been really wonderful.
Wow. What a story. Okay, now for people who don't know, the Goodnight Moon giant diorama that you guys put together is kind of the central part of the story. Is that right? Where it's a room with all of these elements?
The story takes place in a single bedroom. And, you know, there are different views of that bedroom throughout the book, some close-ups and some full room. And so pages 9 and 10 right at the center of the book are the broadest view of the entire room. You get the greatest view of everything in there. So we based the installation off of those two pages.
Okay.
That said, Clement Hurd had a funny little habit of drawing things very differently from page to page. So there was a little bit of just deciding between the two of us, which version of the clock are we going to do? Which version of the mouse are we going to do? So we have morphed some of Clement Hurd's different versions into our final exhibit. But yeah, that's the 500 square foot is that entire bedroom.
So the centerfold of the book is what you guys built.
Correct.
Wow.
Exactly.
All right. So, Ken, did you have a space for this initially, or are we building and then finding a space?
Oh, yeah. We built it and then found the space.
Okay.
When we first started this project, you know, it was intended to travel, mm-hmm. which is why we designed it the way that we did, so it could be, you know, the whole thing is modular. It comes apart, goes back together. And it's not easy to find a venue that can house an installation of this magnitude because timing comes into play. If, you know, if you're a community art center or a gallery or a museum, you're likely booked a couple years in advance.
Sure, sure.
And, you know, we have a spontaneous streak that runs through us. And so, you know, we've got this giant installation going, okay, well, 2 years for them, 2 years for them, you know? And so we live in Southern Colorado and we have this absolutely wonderful studio on the third floor of what is one of the best Western art museums in the United States.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it is spectacular. And just down the street, there is this old Studebaker garage that had been renovated into exhibition, event, meeting, artist, live, work, lofty kind of thing. And they left the garage portion of this building is an entire city block. And in the middle of the city block is, you know, a place called Space to Create. And it's a 20,000 square foot garage that everything had just been remodeled. The floors were redone. I mean, they were concrete floors, so they were washed and polished and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But a 20,000 square foot, I mean, the ceilings in that thing got to be 40 feet. I mean,
yeah,
it is
yeah.
amazing. And, when this building, when it had its grand opening, our piece Frog was like the centerpiece art wise for the grand opening of this thing. And then, we're like, hey, we've got another piece. Can we put Goodnight Moon in there too? And, they said, yeah, sure. And so originally we were supposed to be, we opened on May 5th, I believe, and we were only supposed to be in there for a month. But immediately when they saw it, they're like, hey, would you like to keep it in there for another month? And we're like, of course we would.
Yeah,
we just got done putting this thing up. And it enjoyed an uninterrupted six-month inaugural show where – you know, according, you know, to the organization, around 10,000 people got to see Goodnight Moon.
Wow.
And when you are in a town of 8,000 people, 10,000 people is a really good number. And you got to kind of wonder, you know, where'd the other 2,000 people come from? And we had people that came in from both coasts, different states. It really was a phenomenal original, you know, initial showing, which did help us to, you know, start to travel this exhibit. So, you know, we got a date in 2025, one in 2026, and another one that's in the works, that we're super excited about, but can't say anything.
Yeah.
Which is a part of, that's one of the things that, that we go back and forth around is we have a very, our relationship to cart and horse is different, but aligned. Mm. And, Emily leans towards, under promising and over delivering and not wanting anybody to know anything about anything. And which I totally understand and appreciate much more than I used to, because as the spreader of the word and the generator of excitement, like I'm like, yeah, so, and I would just dribble little tidbits and fun facts about stuff. And I did get in trouble a couple of times for doing that, but
yeah, I can see those discussions. Like, what are you doing to me? Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. Yep.
Uh-huh. Don't tell people. But you know, 10 years on and, we're very much, in closer alignment about the benefits of holding on to, the story, the energy, the secret, because I don't know if you've ever had this experience where you've been working on something and then you tell somebody about it and it sort of saps the energy.
Right.
And the next thing you know, that's a work in progress sitting in a bag in the corner of a room somewhere, never to be picked up again, which is a risk when you're making these giant, you know, fiber installations.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've definitely, I think, are navigating our way into a space where we get to like keep the secret, but find ways to share certain things that might titillate the audience.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? So Goodnight Moon, then you design all this so that it can be, it's all modularized so you can move it, set it up in a different place. Is it flexible enough that it can be in different size spaces, or is there kind of a minimum limit?
Well, not in its entirety. We have, you know, Goodnight Moon, you know, the Great Green Room is a room. And so it has never occurred to us, you know, to break up the family, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah.
However, you know, we deal with the constraints as they're presented to us, and sometimes space is an issue. And so, you know, we've discussed sort of breaking it into thirds. You know, we've discussed making a smaller version that might be easier to travel. But so far, we've really held out for a suitable venue that can hold the entire, you know, the installation it's in entirety, so that people, because really what's happening is, you know, this is an imaginary world. I mean, when Margaret wrote this book, it was a landmark book, and it was really groundbreaking because of her approach to children's literature, moving from, you know, fairies and make-believe to realism. And I know that I read this book to my son when he was little, but I do not have the same memory and emotional attachment to it that Emily does. And it, you know, finding suitable venues, I sort of lost my train of thought there.
Yeah.
Suitable venues that can take this thing in its entirety is a real challenge. And so one of the things we've done to sort of work around that is moving into theater spaces.
Okay.
Because, you know, small communities might not have a venue suitable for 500 square feet, but a lot of them have a theater.
Right.
And so...
and I'm sure many are looking to do something with that theater,
musical,
too. Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. So, you know, we've had to get real creative and figure out like how, you know, what are the different ways that we can travel this show into communities that otherwise might not see it, like Trinidad. You know, a piece of art like this doesn't travel to Trinidad.
Yeah.
You know, so for us, it was really important that we launch from the community where we live and work.
Right.
And people really seem to love it. And we love that. So,
yeah,
you know,
we're going to do Goodnight Moon. We're going to do The Room. But now you got to actually execute it. And I got to believe that that is a ton of trial and error knitting.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
It was, I thought, given my background and given the fact that I'm the one who decided to do this, that I had a pretty good handle on what was going to be required of me, and I did not. It was much more massive than I had anticipated, and what I found is that every day I would make a list of everything I needed to get done, and by the end of the day, somehow the list was longer. And it happened every single day because we counted, and without counting duplicates of anything inside of the room and without counting elements of any particular element inside of the room, there are 52 different designs inside of this room. Most of which have several elements going on inside of them. So there was a lot to do and a whole lot of trial and error. That said, we were on a deadline, which is very helpful. We both work very well on a deadline. If we had given ourselves longer, we would have taken longer. As it was, we literally were putting the finishing touches on the installation 1 minute after the curtain was supposed to go up.
Oh, no.
So we definitely take every bit of time we give ourselves. But yeah, it was just months of constant knitting and talking to myself about something being good enough. Good enough is good enough because it has to be good enough because there are now 51 more things to make.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can be really, really persnickety about things. And I did my best to be. But sometimes. Yeah, I can be a little bit persnickety. And I really had to talk to myself about it because I, you know, we just didn't have enough time to be that persnickety on every single piece. But yeah, just constant trial and error. There's definitely no pattern book out there for every single element of Goodnight Moon.
Yeah. Well, that was, and that was one of my questions, you know, that artist question of when is it finished? When is it functional? When is it doing the job? And I need to stop because I'm driving myself nuts. I mean, I can imagine you get through that 52 times 20. Yeah.
Absolutely. And like I said, having the deadline is helpful because, you know, if you don't have a deadline, you don't have a hard stop, that question is much more difficult to answer. When am I actually done?
Right.
Which is why some of us have half-finished pieces in our studios for years. So deadlines are incredibly helpful. It's done because it has to be done.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm sure we can line up 1,000 artists and they all have the same issues. So no problem there whatsoever.
Yeah.
All right. So we finish this thing. It goes on display. Huge success. I mean, an 8,000 resident town and you get 10,000 people. They keep extending the thing. I mean, this has just got to be beyond your dreams to have this be so successful. And then is it moved on? Do we have other than other locations for this? How many times?
Well, it's only shown once.
Okay.
So our second, you know, it's a monumental undertaking. So our, like I said, we've got a show in the fall of 25, another one spring of 26. And we have a, we're going on tour.
Oh, okay.
And neither one of us, you know, in some ways this is, you know, this is a completely, you know, unique undertaking because one, neither one of us had ever made a Goodnight Moon traveling exhibit before. And we've never, I mean, we're not musicians, so it's not like we've been on, you know, tour before.
Right.
And we hadn't really, you know, had to get into the world of, you know, museums and to, you know, scheduling out in advance. So there's been a bit of a, you know, there's been a bit of a learning curve, but I also think that, you know, one of the things that, one of the ways that we soothe ourselves, is everything's happening exactly the way it's supposed to. And the reason that we know that is because that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so while we might have gone, oh, yeah, let's take it down out of Trinidad and take it immediately to some other place and just be nonstop Goodnight Moon for the rest of our lives. And, you know, the universe had different plans. It's, you know, it's taken time to figure out how to get this thing to travel to different places.
Yeah.
And so while there's a part of us that, you know, might wish that this were already underway, you know, I think I'm excited because I think if we had tried to push it, then you know, the opportunities that are starting to present themselves that are so far out of what we would have imagined probably would not have happened. So you know, we're happy to wait, and we'd rather not have to, but we will.
For those listening, the sound in the background is the dog, but that's okay.
I apologize. Oh,
no. Hey, we've had cats, we've had dogs, we've had trains, we've had trucks. It's no big deal. We're used to it.
He's a great studio dog, but he is kind of pushy.
All right. Now, of course, now we're completely out of time, but I got to know more things. So, Emily, talk to me about the materials. It yarns, and you already had the needles. I mean, that you had an inside track on the needles, but what did you learn about the materials to knit all of these and crochet all of these pieces? Was that a challenge just in its own right to find stuff thick enough, quality enough? I mean, because you can't just use cheap acrylic, I got to believe.
Well, and we're talking specifically for Moon here.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, you can and must use less expensive yarn on something like this.
Yeah, okay.
You just must. Mm-hmm. I wish that we were using merino wool for this entire installation. Not a reasonable way to spend our funds.
Right. So, could never afford it, I'm assuming.
Could never afford it. So there, you know, requiring so much yarn, which I couldn't even have imagined how much I needed before starting all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So that was tricky too, trying to figure out how much yarn to order. We got very lucky and ended up doing our second project before Goodnight Moon, which was Frog. We used the same yarn for that. So I did get to have like a little bit of a preview of it.
Uh-huh.
But for Goodnight Moon, almost all of the yarn, not 100%, but almost all of it is your very standard number 4 acrylic or acrylic blend.
Oh.
And the way that we have numerous textures in here, which is a challenge because my knitting machine carriage is broken and has been so for several years now.
Oh,
so I literally only have one setting on my knitting machine.
Oh,
that's been a really fun constraint to work with. So one broken knitting machine on one setting and one weight of yarn.
Mm.
So the way that I handled that is some of it is a single strand. Some of it is a double. Some of it is a triple. Some of it is 11 strands.
Oh.
And I just made the yarn as thick as I needed it to be for whatever project I was working on. I changed up the textures as often as I could to keep myself interested and so that not every single thing in the room looked exactly the same.
Yeah.
If I had had a year, I would have done a lot more of that, but I did as much as I could to make things interesting. But other than the bunnies, which are made out of a jumbo chenille yarn, and the kittens that are made out of a chunky faux fur yarn, everything else is a number 4 acrylic or acrylic blend.
Just because of pure
economics.
Just in
some form of combination. Because of economics, for simplicity's sake, the reality is, like, yes, I could do more with more yarn.
Right. But
sometimes having those constraints is very helpful in streamlining it. And, you know, I think this installation looks really, really clean, which I love. I'm not a big fan of mess. And I think that forcing ourselves to use very, very simple yarns and only changing the texture by changing the stitch or adding an extra strand or two of that very same yarn kept everything really clean and smooth.
Yeah, yeah. Have you modified things, improved things during its run, or is it as you set it up?
It is pretty much as we set it up. Now, the very first weekend, the mouse was stolen.
Oh, come on. Oh, jeez, really?
Somebody had a little tea party. We came in the following morning and, you know, somebody had clearly taken all of the animals and set them down on the rug and had their own little tea party and walked away with the mouse. So so that is not the original. That one did have to get remade that first weekend, but no one stole the second one, fortunately. And we are in the process now. In fact, you can see behind me, I have several of these. Which way do I move? You can see the clock over here behind me. I have several of our Goodnight Moon pieces in the studio right now because we're in the process of going through with a fine tooth comb, preparing for the next showing, making sure there's no snag here or there. You know, everything's in really good shape, but before we take it back out, we're going to go through it with a fine tooth comb and make sure everything is good. I will say that is one level of frustration that on the one hand, since we were so rushed and nothing is perfect and we could point out all of the flaws in all 52 different designs and feel compelled to redo them. And there's a part of me that thought I would want to redo them after we took it down. And I have to say, maybe I'll change my mind, but as imperfect as some of these pieces are in my mind, I think they're just fine. But I can't seem to get myself to replace them. I thought about replacing an element a couple of weeks ago, and I felt a little bit of sadness in me. Clearly, I have anthropomorphized our work here because I felt like that element would feel rejected if I replaced it and that it wouldn't be like with all of its moon buddies anymore. So, you know, I don't think anything's getting remade. I think it is a moment in time. And and I think it's supposed to be what it is. Usually that's how it is. In my experience, the work generally tells me what it wants to be. And I'm pretty sure it told me that it wants to be exactly what it already is.
So make sure everything's in order and leave it as it is. All right. Now I got to stop and I could go on for another hour. I'm telling you, I got so many questions, but we got to stop here. When is the next showing? Can we say when the next showing is and where?
Yes, actually, the next one we have a solid date for.
Yeah, the next one is the last week of September at the Dairy Arts Center in Boulder, Colorado. And for that production, we're actually partnering with an improvisational theater ensemble where we're going to... you know, the One Story Many Voices component of this original project revealed to us just how central this story is to the lives of so many people. And we really want to tease that out. So up in Boulder, we're going to be doing a sort of a deep dive into the audience experience where people are going to be able to get up and tell their personal story around Goodnight Moon.
Okay.
And then the improv troupe creates a piece of theater around that. And so we got another one in Colorado in 2026 where the exhibition is going to be there's a Goodnight Moon, the musical, which is going to be produced here in Colorado. And the installation is actually the set or the backdrop for that musical. So we're getting to find really creative and innovative ways to bring this piece of artwork to the community.
Right.
And I'm not sure that any two shows are ever going to be the same. So we're having lots of fun with it. So yeah, September in Boulder, the spring of 26 in Parker, Colorado, and hopefully we'll have, you know, a life altering announcement to make here in a couple of weeks and its third show. And if we, you know, when those details become available, we'll certainly let you know.
Yeah. 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 Please do. Okay. And just real quick, you know, I know that people listening to this are going to say, all right, how, where's the money part of this thing? So you get sponsors, different corporate sponsors to help underwrite this, these,
you know, we've been fortunate with some grants.
Okay.
You know, sponsorships, partnerships, you know,
all those things. Yeah.
Yeah. Everything that we need to bring together in order to pull it off is what we do.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so yeah.
Yep. Okay. All right. Fantastic story. Thanks so much for writing to me so that we can do this show. And for your time, what a tremendous thing. And it's DundeeandLee.com. Dundee, D-U-N-D-E-E, the word and then L-E-E.com is the website. And there's several videos, and you get to see some of Emily's early commercial work. There's some videos of that, too, that are pretty cool. The one with the car with the yarn going off the back, and that was Nissan, I think, wasn't it?
Infiniti.
Infiniti, yeah. But the videos are a ton of fun. Trust me, I know I watched every single one of them. So so DundeeandLee.com and check their website. And I'm sure on there, I didn't take time to look, but it will be the schedule for when and where these things are at. And then I assume there are more designs in the works. So, yeah, okay, more.
Maybe. Yep.
More. Yeah, we've got a new piece called Stampede that's going to open at the A.R. Mitchell Museum in May. I think it's May. Yep. So that'll be running in the museum for three of the exhibitions that they have going. And then, you know, I'm working right now to find other venues. So
yeah. Impressive stuff. Thanks so much for sharing it with us. And thanks to everyone for listening.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.